Mind Matters, a one-hour programme that shares all things psychology. Mind Matters will host a variety of guests, from neuropsychologists and prison psychologists to those with lived experience of mental health challenges. We aim to share knowledge and experience, encourage interesting dialogue and reduce stigma. Join us on Monday evenings from 6 to 7pm on 3CR 855am. Hello and welcome to tonight's episode of Mind Matters on 3CR 855am, 3CR digital or online at 3cr.org.au. My name is Kirsty and I am pleased to be your host this evening. This week we'll be discussing eating disorders and the research being done by the University of Melbourne's Physical Appearance Research Team. If this is a sensitive or triggering topic, please feel free to tune out now. As always, for those who are looking for support or simply need someone to talk to, contact the Wellways helpline at 1300 111 400. I'm joined in the studio today by Dr. Isabel Krug, an academic at the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences and team leader of the Melbourne University Physical Appearance Research Team, or PART for short. Isabel is a senior lecturer in clinical psychology at the University of Melbourne with a main research focus on eating disorders, body image, and eating pathology. Isabel's research focuses on a range of genetic, environmental, and psychological risk factors for eating pathology. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Can you begin by giving us a bit of a background as to how you wound up in your current roles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for the question and thanks for having me as well. So my role at the University of Melbourne at the School of Psychological Sciences is a teaching and research role. So I teach into the course of clinical psychology, and that's specifically a master course.
Yeah.
And I'm the course coordinator of two modules there, basic intervention and assessment and diagnosis, and I also teach eating disorder lectures into other undergraduate and postgraduate modules, and I also take part in other teaching activities for this master course, I also do obviously research supervision, which is quite an important role.
Yeah.
So I do research supervision at various levels. This includes honors, master theses, PhD students. Have to write papers, obviously, apply yeah. for grants, review articles, and we have to, as a member of the school, you also have to join various committees within the school, but also joining committees from the eating disorder organizations, such as the Australian and New Zealand Academy for Eating Disorders and the International Academy for Eating Disorders. And finally, you also have to do quite a bit of engagement and advocacy work. And in that role, I mainly try to engage with eating disorder units across hospitals around Melbourne, and also to establish research collaborations there.
God, you do quite a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I'm a mother as well. So I have a baby and I'm expecting another one. So it's quite difficult to juggle everything at once.
Yeah, but I can imagine.
Yeah.
What do you spend the majority of your time doing?
It depends on the time of the semester. So if obviously it's a teaching period, then it can be quite a lot of time focusing on teaching, especially because I'm now doing intensive teaching in the summer semester. And then a lot of research supervision as well, because I normally take on quite a few students. And there's also a lot of admin work that you have to do, which takes quite a lot of your time away. So,
Yeah. So how did you come to focus on eating disorders?
So that was when I was doing my undergraduate, when I was actually, I studied in the UK. So my undergraduate, I did it at the Cardiff University. And there, our third year is similar to the honours degree that you do in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And so before actually engaging into my third year, I did an internship at a psychosomatic ward in Germany, Ulm. And there was a lady from Romania, and she did research on risk and protective factors of eating disorder. in former communist countries such as Romania.
Yeah.
And so she kind of gave me the idea to do my research project on a similar cultural topic. And so I investigated the role of eating disorders with the former German Democratic Republic, and so assessed eating patterns in women that grew up in Eastern Germany compared to the ones in Western Europe. We didn't find any differences, but yeah, that kind of started my interest in eating disorders. And then I continued to do a master project on eating disorders,
yeah,
and then my PhD. So always actually done something on eating disorder.
Yeah. So before this internship, did you have any like preference for this topic or?
Not really, no. It was also because the psychosomatic ward where I did my internship, they also concentrated and focused quite a bit on eating disorders.
Okay.
So I was also able to kind of observe clients go through the different treatment modalities that they offered. And so, yep, and that kind of, I guess, fostered my interest in eating disorders then.
Can you tell us a bit about what the most prevalent eating disorders in this Western society is?
Yes. So according to the, well, we work with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Yeah.
And that's to kind of diagnose mental health problems. And so the most, the ones described there are obviously anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, and otherwise not specified feeding and eating disorders.
Okay.
And so asking about the most prevalent ones, they are all quite low prevalence disorders. So anorexia has a prevalence among, like, maybe I would say about 0.4% in the population.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's low prevalence. Bulimia, about 1.5%, so it's a bit more frequent. And the difference, obviously, between anorexia and bulimia is that the bulimia has the binge-purging cycle as well, though anorexia has a subtype. So there's the restrictive subtype, and then there's a binge-purging. And they also have binging episodes and compensate with purging behavior. But normally the difference between anorexia and bulimia is that anorexia are a low weight, so it's, say, maybe lower than 18.5, if you think about the BMI range.
Yeah.
And so then binge eating disorder is quite a new category within the DSM-5. And those people suffering from binge eating disorder, they have binges, but they don't compensate in any other way. So they are different from bulimia or anorexia, binge purging.
Okay.
And they are more frequent. I guess there's a lot of variation in terms of the prevalence rates. I'd say maybe between 1.6 and 2% of the population. And a lot of people with binge eating disorder often are also overweight.
Yeah.
And then the OSFED, we don't really have good prevalence rates because they're very heterogeneous. So those could be any type of eating disorder that doesn't meet the criteria for the other eating disorder that I just outlined. And I think if we look at community samples, we can say that the prevalence rate could be between 3% and 6%. But again, there's a lot of variety in terms of what research has shown in terms of prevalence rates. And then we look at eating pathology in the community.
Yeah.
These are obviously a lot more prevalent. So I'd say that there's a much higher occurrence of those problematic behaviors within our society. But those people might not be unwell enough to seek treatment or might not really develop the clinical diagnosis. So
by eating pathology, can you define what that means?
Yeah, that could be anything. It could range for, it's lots of different kind of pathologies. It could be restrictive eating that kind of has a severe impact on one's life. But also within the community, we see that people do have binge episodes, so overeating in a discrete period of time, a much larger amount of food that other people would eat. Also, some people might use vomiting as a compensatory behavior, or diuretics or laxatives. So those are kind of, or excessive exercise as well.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the symptoms that are common in clinical eating disorders and in the community, people with eating pathology, but maybe to maybe a less severe extent, if I can say it like that, yeah.
Okay. Can you talk about some of the common misconceptions around eating disorders?
Yeah, there's quite a few, actually.
Yeah.
So I guess one of the most compelling, or one that you hear quite a lot, is that you can tell by looking at someone if they've had an eating disorder or not.
Yeah.
And that's obviously not true, because eating disorders come in all shapes and sizes. And in fact, the DSM-5 actually now also includes people with eating disorder diagnosis that are on normal weight or overweight.
Yeah.
And you can still get a diagnosis of atypical anorexia if you have lost a lot of weight. And yeah, so you don't have to also be overweight or obese to have binge eating disorders. So it can really happen on anywhere on the BMI spectrum.
Yeah.
Another misconception is that eating disorder are a choice. Obviously, that's not true. And we do know that they are a clinic illness, so it's not a choice. And they're very complex and multifactorial disorders.
Yeah.
And so, there's also a high component of biological risk factors to them. Another misconception is that eating disorders are of whiter upper and middle class teenage girls. And
yeah.
Obviously that's also not true, because the eating disorders, they don't differentiate about your race or your ethnicity, your gender or your socioeconomic status. So they come across all of those lines.
Yeah.
So we do also see a lot of middle-aged women nowadays that suffer from eating pathology. And obviously it's problematic when they approach their GP and the GP says, you can't have this illness because it's normally a teenage problem. Or also a lot of guys that obviously say that the professionals might say, you know, this is a female disorder, so you can't have that. So there's lots of males that get undiagnosed and they don't get the right treatment options as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What kind of demographic is eating disorders most prevalent in?
It is actually most of the demographic studies have shown that at the age of onset is most likely in the late teens, early 20s.
Yeah.
And also a lot of times of higher socioeconomic status. So I think that's kind of this, and obviously in Western countries, so that's the literature does kind of outline that, but that doesn't mean that obviously it doesn't happen in other populations as well. So
where does it happen more in that population though?
Well, puberty has been found to be a risk factor.
Yeah.
So that's obviously, and obviously there's with puberty and the changes that happen to your body, also social influences happening more at those ages maybe than other ages, such as bullying from other teens, maybe about your weight or if you're an early developer compared to maybe somebody that might develop at a normal time or later. So there are specific risk factors associated to those particular kind of times in life.
So this kind of goes into the next question, actually. So your research focuses on a range of genetic, environmental and psychological risk factors for eating pathology.
Mm.
So can you discuss what these factors are and how they can lead to disordered eating behaviour?
Yeah, so as I said before, eating disorder are multifactorial disorders. A lot of times when I say that, actually genetics has quite an important influence, people are quite surprised because they think that most of the risk factors are more environmental or psychological. But there's a lot of research actually on the genetics of eating disorders. So there's quite a lot of twin studies, for instance, that have shown that the heritability of eating pathology can vary between 50% to 60%, for instance, for broadly defined anorexia, and is slightly higher for bulimia and binge eating, so between 58% to about 80%. So we know that from twin studies. There's also candidate gene studies that have looked at one specific gene and have found that the gene is more implicated in eating disorder cases rather than controls. And the newest line of research is called genome-wide association studies. So there they actually assess the whole genome to see if there's any kind of specific areas of the genome that are associated with the illness. But for that type of research, you need really, really big sample sizes. So there's a lot of very new research that has done multi-center approaches to collect all eating disorder cases that they've been able to gather. So they need kind of sample sizes in the thousands. And so far, most of the GWAS haven't found a hit, but they think it's due to low the sample sizes not being big enough. So they're trying to collect more sample sizes, and hopefully there'll be something interesting coming out from those studies very soon. In terms of environmental factors, well, we know that there's interpersonal factors that are related to eating disorders, such as having troubled relationship. We've done a study where we actually saw that people with eating disorders already had low social interactions in childhood, so before they actually started having a problem. So there's obviously a history of having been teased about the body size or weight, so that's quite influential. We've also done a study on childhood feeding difficulties and did find that people with eating disorders had more kind of picky eating during childhood compared to controls. Obviously, there's also history of trauma, sexual and physical or mental abuse. That's quite prevalent, especially we found patients with bulimia. Obviously, there's also social factors, so the media and cultural pressures. And nowadays, I think especially social media is quite an important contributing factor as well. So our group does quite a bit of research on the effects of social media on eating pathology. And I'm happy to talk about that more later in the next questions. And obviously people of specific professions such as maybe dancers or models, they might be at an increased risk for eating disorders as well. And then finally the psychological kind of risk factors. So we know that personality is one of the main risk factors, especially perfectionism. And then you can see perfectionism across the whole spectrum of eating disorders. In terms of other personality traits, the restrictive eating disorders are quite different to the binge purging pathologies. So the restrictive, I would say, are more obsessional, perfectionistic, socially inhibited. They score really high on harm avoidance as well, and they are a lot of times emotionally quite restrained and have inflexible thinking. The binge purging types, so anorexia binge purging or bulimia, they are a lot more impulsive and have more extroverted personality. So those have been also found to be quite comorbid with personality disorders such as borderline personality disorder and also higher substance abuse or any other kind of impulsive behavior.
Are any of those risk factors more prominent than the others, or does it just depend on a case-by-case basis?
I would say it depends a lot on the case-by-case, because there might be some people, obviously, that encounter a lot of those risk factors and they never present with an eating disorders, and other people that might maybe encounter one or two risk factors and that might be enough for them to trigger illness in them. And also dieting and body dissatisfaction have been found to be one of the most proximal risk factors to then establish an actual eating disorder. But I think it's difficult to say which. I mean, I think perfectionism is something that you can see in a lot of the across the whole spectrum of eating disorders. But other than that, I think it's difficult to say.
So how come there's situations where some people are exposed to the risk factors, but they don't develop an eating disorder?
That's a very good question. Yeah. I don't think we know the answer for that. We just don't know. A lot of people might be exposed to a lot of the risk factors, and a lot of these risk factors are not just specific for eating disorders. They could also be applicable to other mental health problems. Mm. And so why would somebody specifically develop an eating disorder rather than an anxiety or depression or substance use? I think that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer for that.
Okay. So you're the team leader of the Melbourne University Physical Appearance Research Team. Can you discuss what your team researches and the current research projects that are underway?
Yeah, so this the physical appearance research team is actually led by also by Scott Griffith, and so and then we have various research students and other people that obviously are involved in the team. Currently the team is doing a lot of very research cutting across the spectrum of eating disorders, and so I'm looking on eating disorder and disordered eating behaviors. Scott is very interested in muscle dysmorphia and anabolic steroid dependence and height and genital dissatisfaction. We also do quite a lot of work, as I mentioned before, on social media influences, especially the influence of the Fitspiration, that is quite a new kind of media image where some women and men also are portrayed in a muscular way. Mm-hmm. We are looking at the effects of those images. Also have PhD student looking at the overlap between autistic traits and eating disorders. Mm-hmm. Doing quite a bit of ecological momentary assessment as well at the moment. We've been looking at an oxytocin intervention. A lot of different areas.
And what are some of your team's most recent findings?
We have had students looking this year, as I mentioned, on the effects of the Fitspiration on eating pathology. They used an ecological momentary assessment design whereby they got exposed to either Fitspiration images or neutral images. And so then they had to rate their body image and eating pathology before and after seeing those images. And we did find that the Fitspiration images did have a negative effect, especially on body dissatisfaction, on eating pathology, not so much mood. There was one research project. We also looked at self-tracking devices such as the Fitbits, and we've collected quite a bit of data on Fitbit use, because there's some anecdotal evidence that suggests that self-tracking devices could trigger eating behaviors due to the obsessional checking that is related, and obviously eating pathology is also characterized by obsessionality. This year we actually manipulated the Fitbit leaderboard and to see whether if somebody has to compare themselves to somebody on the leaderboard that actually does do quite well in terms of step counts, they would engage in maybe more exercise behavior, and that would then maybe trigger also more body dissatisfaction and eating pathology. But we actually didn't find the effects that we thought we would find. Mm. So it doesn't look like that Fitbits actually are likely to trigger from our research, or maybe we don't have enough evidence and there would need to be more research that needs to be done. Our current findings don't suggest that they are in that way as dangerous as we thought that they might be, but there's no research at all in the literature. I think there needs to be more research. We also did an interesting study on Ramadan, the effects of Ramadan, that's the fasting people of an Islamic background do for a month, and because they're not allowed to eat anything from dawn to sunset, that maybe the long fasting period could trigger binging behavior. So we also used ecological mammary assessment to assess that and ask people for 7 days to report their eating behaviors. But we also didn't find any effects of the long fasting periods having an effect. But again, that was the first study that was published in this area using the design that we used. So it was interesting to write it up and it was good as well to be able to publish it. Got quite a good feedback, even though we didn't find the effects. But
do you think you're going to do some future studies on that topic?
We have already collected more data actually. Yeah. So we actually this year during Ramadan, because it's actually it's difficult to collect data for Ramadan because it happens just once a year. So we've collected actually we have data on about 700 people that engaged in Ramadan, and we're very lucky because we actually have contacts from the Middle East who helped us collect the data. And so we have a structural equationing modeling that we want to test with that data. So it's not longitudinal data this time that we had with the previous study, so hopefully there'll be something interesting there as well.
I am currently talking to Dr. Isabel Krug of the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences on the topic of eating disorders. Stay tuned throughout this song break and join us for more interesting conversation on Mind Matters 3CR 855 AM. Just listening to Notion by Tash Sultana. You are listening to Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM, a 1 hour programme every Monday 6 till 7 pm on all things psychology. We're joined back in the studio by Dr. Isabel Krug from the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences, and we're talking about the topic of eating disorders and the research that she's done into this topic. So you're also interested in the effectiveness of new treatment modalities for individuals with eating pathology, including mindfulness, oxytocin, TMS, virtual reality and telemedicine. Can you explain what these treatment modalities are and why they may be effective?
Mindfulness refers to the notion of living, existing and valuing the present moment. And so the practice of mindfulness is specifically important for people struggling with eating disorders because people with eating disorders, they easily get caught up in negative thoughts such as, for instance, if I eat this meal, I will get fat, or no one likes me. If I was thin, I would have friends. That obviously often leaves the individual being distracted and overwhelmed with negative emotions. And so it's important there for the person to stop and be able to redirect their own thoughts. And so mindfulness can do that by tackling different senses. It can be practiced also intentionally through meditation and just allowing the mind to clear up and focus on positive issues and the present moment, and so not permitting those negative thoughts or emotions to approach the individual. And so there are quite a few mindfulness studies within the eating disorder literature, and they've shown to be effective showing, for instance, eating disorder patients to eat in a mindful way. And also kind of decreasing other kinds of eating disorder symptoms. So it's a promising area, but I think again there needs to be more kind of systematic research that to show the effectiveness. It's not one of the treatment modalities that is currently recommended. Obviously, cognitive behavior therapy and family therapy for anorexia are the first line of treatments for eating disorders. So.
Yeah.
In terms of oxytocin, well, as I mentioned before, one of the risk factors for oxytocin is to have social difficulties, and they often start early in life. And so these social problems can result in isolation and can be important triggering factors and maintaining factors for eating disorders. Oxytocin is actually called often the cuddle hormone, and it actually is a hormone that is naturally released during bonding and childbirth and breastfeeding.
Yeah.
There's been a few studies mainly done from the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College London, led by Janet Treasure, that actually have shown that oxytocin intervention, that's a spray, a nasal spray that you give the individuals, that actually has helped dealing with social interaction problems and also eating disordered kind of behaviors. So it looks like it's a promising area, but again, not enough research. And there needs to be kind of more replication studies also from other parts of the world. In terms of TMS, it's also quite a new research line and intervention for eating disorders. So it stands for transmagnetic stimulation, and it's a mild, non-invasive form of brain stimulation.
Yeah.
And it's been effective in other pathologies such as depression and obsessive-compulsive disorders. And so more recently, again, this has been led by Ulrike Schmidt from the Institute of Psychiatry and King's College. They have actually done a few case reports where they used a TMS to help with often also treatment-resistant anorexia patients, and also it's been applied to bulimia. They found that TMS was quite helpful. So again, we're hoping to be able to do some research here in Melbourne and to see whether TMS with a different location of the brain, because so far it's just been one location that has been targeted, to see if that's effective. Virtual reality, right? Yes. Okay. We used a program, virtual reality, where basically there was a virtual kitchen, and patients were able to kind of open the fridges, and there was different types of foods, ranging in the kind of threatening foods from they could take out a salad to a chocolate a cake or pizza, and there were also cupboards, and there was food there as well, and so. So with the patients, that was actually when I was doing a postdoc at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. So we used that virtual reality there, and we did find that bulimia patients really liked using virtual reality because they normally have problems regulating the speed of their eating, or it was helpful for them in that sense. Anorexia patient thought it was helpful because they were able to build a hierarchy, so they could start with a less threatening food such as the salad, and then gradually kind of build up the different food items that were present, and then within the sessions they were able to also test these types of meals in real life. Overall I think it's maybe a little bit more helpful for the anorexia patients than the bulimia patients, but we tested it in both. So, and then finally for telemedicine, these are mainly online interventions. And so when I was doing my PhD it was actually in Barcelona at the eating disorder unit there at the University Hospital of Bellvitge, we did use a self-help online guide for bulimia. And so they were like modules, and people could go through them on their own pace. But they also had a therapist that they could email if they had any questions. And there were some sessions that were done face-to-face, but a lot of it was online. And we did find that the treatment modality was helpful in reducing bulimia symptoms. And obviously now the technology has advanced, and so we've now started to incorporate different treatment interventions through a mobile app. And so we've done a body dissatisfaction intervention recently, using also mindfulness techniques. And yeah, we found that that helped as well increase body satisfaction. It wasn't a clinical sample, it was a community sample. But yeah, so I think there's a lot of space for that, especially in Australia, where maybe people live quite far away from the treatment centers. And so that could be another option for them to obviously have access to treatment.
Okay, yeah. And what are your predictions for the future direction of research?
There's a lot of research that needs to be done in the area of eating disorder. I feel like compared to other mental health problems, a lot of times, even though we are trying to do a lot of work, but because we are a very small community, we are behind other pathologies in all types of research. But in terms of etiological research, I think we do need more methodologically rigorous prospective risk and protective factor studies, and that they involve larger samples and longer follow-up periods that we currently have with validated objective measures.
Yeah.
The problem a lot of times with longitudinal studies is that they use abbreviated measures or just not so psychometrically sound measures. And a broader also array of risk factors and protective factors needs to be assessed. I think, a combination of psychological, biological and environmental factors together would be important. And I think the kind of multi-center projects that have collected data for the GWAS project also have very rich information on psychological and other risk factors, and I hope that in the future they will be able to make use of all this really useful information and data to have these type of large and data sets to do those type of etiological research. There's some research coming out on the gut microbiome as a biological factor and whether that's involved in as a risk factor for eating disorders. So I think that might be something that, that will obviously be more prominent in the near future. In terms of treatment research, I think there needs to be more research on the maintaining factors for eating pathology, and there needs to be more rigorous treatment trials that involve credible placebo interventions, because a lot of times I think the control interventions are maybe not as well designed as they could be, and sometimes it's really hard to have a really well designed study for that as well. And it would be really good to have novel treatments such as neuromodulation, TMS or oxytocin studied in a more systematic way. I think that's and using maybe more ecological momentary assessment with treatment would be interesting as well, because it's possible to use EMA as well in a tailored way. So if they respond in the moment to a question, they can maybe on the phone also get a useful advice in that specific moment. So that would be good.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am currently talking to Dr. Isabel Krug of the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences on the topic of eating disorders. Stay tuned throughout this song break and join us for more interesting conversation on Mind Matters 3CR 855 AM. The song that was just playing was Something Good by Alt-J. I'm back in the studio with Dr. Isabel Krug, an academic from the Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences, and we're talking about eating disorders. So in March of this year, you co-authored an article on the contribution of social media to body dissatisfaction on eating disorder symptoms and anabolic steroid use among sexual minority men. Can you discuss your findings and the broad implications that these have for society?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Research was led by Scott Griffith. The study looked at about 2,700 sexual minority men, and they completed an online survey. And so participant answered questions about social media use and also questions about dating app use, body image and eating disorder symptoms and anabolic steroids. And so the main findings of the studies were that Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Snapchat were the most frequently used social media platforms.
Yeah.
And we also found a small size positive association between social media and body dissatisfaction and eating disorder symptoms and thoughts about using anabolic steroids. And so the associations of social media use with eating disorder symptoms were stronger for image-centering social media platforms such as Instagram rather than non-image-centering platforms such as WordPress. So that was an important finding as well. And that's kind of also in concordance with other research that looked at the difference between image-centering media platforms and non-image-centering platforms. So.
Okay, we spoke a bit earlier about the impact of social media.
Mm.
Do you mind kind of unpacking that a bit more?
The impact of social media is quite different to the impact that you would possibly get from other normally the other influences that have been established as risk factors could be either influences from the peer or the family.
Yeah.
I think in social media, if somebody provides comments, it's a lot more direct. People don't have this kind of face-to-face kind of fear of communicating something to the other person. So they are a lot more blunt, and that's obviously quite dangerous. Another problem with social media is obviously that we don't really know how trustworthy the images that people use are.
Mm-hmm.
So you might look on the Facebook accounts of your friends and see that your friend obviously looks beautiful and to you she looks or he looks really slim, but mm-hmm. we don't really know what kind of editing has been done behind that. And so I think it's a lot more dangerous in that way than maybe traditional media sources, which also obviously have been modified. But I think it's much easier to do it online. I think there are specific risks in the social media community that you don't really see in other kind of interactions with people or other media resources. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you recommend then? Do you recommend that you limit your use of social media or?
Well, I guess that's probably a personal thing, and I don't know what people use the social media for, so it's hard to say. But definitely, there's social media literacy there's quite a bit of research coming out on social media literacy from Sean McLean. She works at Victoria University. So educating yourself about what you are actually encountering on the social media platforms would be really important.
Because I think a lot of people don't realize the impact that it's having on them.
No,
kind of just blindly consume it.
Yes, yeah. So I think, just being more critical in terms of what you encounter there would be very helpful, I think, and just kind of maybe knowing a little bit more about what people might be using in terms of modifying images
Okay. So you also contributed to a paper on the frequency, type and effects of appearance comparisons on disordered eating. What were your findings on this?
Yeah, so there we looked at a sample of about 160 Australian women.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used ecological momentary assessment for this study. And so women were asked to report on their upward and downwards comparison and also eating pathology. And so we found that only upward comparisons relative to non-comparison situations significantly predicted eating disorder outcomes. And we actually didn't find any differences between upward and downward comparison. So upward comparison if you actually compare yourself to a person that is more attractive than you, mm-hmm. and downward comparison is if you compare yourself to another person that is less attractive to you. And so that we actually didn't find any specific differences between upward and downward comparison might suggest that actually both forms of comparison increase the likelihood of body dissatisfaction and disordered eating.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can you explain how insecure attachment and the disconnection and rejection domain of maladaptive schema relate to disordered eating?
Yeah, so that's actually a research direction that has been led by a PhD student of mine that who graduated last year. Yeah. And so she was very interested in rejection sensitivity. So her whole PhD is on that topic. And so she assessed in her that specific study, insecure attachment to the disconnection and rejection domain of maladaptive schemas in the context of eating disorders. And rejection sensitivity was proposed to be a mediator between maladaptive schema and disordered eating. And so she looked at a sample of about 110 eating disorder patients and quite a big control sample, about 510. And participants were asked to complete measures online on the variables that she was interested in. And so what we found is that the measure of maladaptive schemas, rejection sensitivity, and appearance rejection sensitivity were positively correlated. And so according to schema theory, which has been proposed by Young, individuals with schemas in this specific domain are often unable to form secure attachments to others, as they believe that their needs for love, stability, and safety, belonging, and nurturance will not be met. And attachment theory actually, in a similar way, also asserts that for those with this schema domain, the disconnection and rejection domain, that early family environments and are most likely called unstable, abusive, isolated, and rejection. And so it therefore makes sense conceptually and empirically that actually in the current study, rejection, both interpersonal and appearance-based, were found to be correlated with the maladaptive schema in this disconnection and rejection domain. So the schemas, there's a lot of different schemas, it is quite difficult to actually get your head around the different types of schemas, this domain is the one that has been mostly related mental health problems.
All right. And for those people who are listening who believe they themselves or someone they know may have an eating disorder, what advice would you give to them?
For those who believe themselves to have an eating disorder, it would be important if they are ready to get the help to approach their GP, who can then provide them hopefully with appropriate specialized eating disorder a referral to an eating disorder unit or a psychologist. Mm-hmm. Though we've done a bit of research on the knowledge of GPs and have actually seen that in that research that GPs are not always 100% educated on the right symptoms levels. I would also encourage those people to actually reach out directly to eating disorder units, such as Eating Disorders Victoria or the Butterfly Foundations.
Yeah.
And they all provide really good resources on their websites in terms of what kind of treatment access they can get. And they even provide, I know Eating Disorder Victoria provides peer support groups. It'd be important to reach out to those organizations. In terms of someone who knows someone else that might have an eating disorders, I think it would be really important to talk to your friend or family member, or if it's somebody else. So it might be really difficult to talk about the situation, it's still important to address it. I guess you this person might want to choose the right opportunity to talk about that, because often people with eating disorders are afraid to also ask for help. And they might be struggling actually to find the right way to start the conversation. So if that person has seen that, found that this person might be having problems or even can see some early signs and symptoms, I think it's just important to encourage them to also approach help. And I think it's possible that they might encounter a little bit of resistance in the beginning, but I think that shouldn't discourage them to offer them their support and, if possible, to continue trying to outline the importance of treatment. Yeah.
Okay, and what else can someone do to support someone as well as asking them directly? And
yeah, I mean, obviously being there for the person would be important. Helping giving them listening to them. I guess not being judgmental in a way, but still expressing the concern mm-hmm. is very important, and being very patient, as I would say as well, because some people might have lived with this problem for quite a while. I don't think that they can expect them for change to happen immediately. I think, being understanding in that sense, but at the same time trying to make sure that the person does get the right help. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for coming in today and sharing your knowledge and your research.
Thank you for having me here.
That's all right. I hope this has been informative and thought-provoking for our listeners. Thank you for tuning into tonight's episode of Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM. Join us next Monday from 6 PM to 7 PM for more chats on all things psychology.